In case you've been wondering what to do with that hour involved in daylight saving time, I'll just preach an extra hour tonight and you won't have to worry about it anymore. Now that's what I call a nervous laughter. Turn, if you will, please, to the book of James, chapter 1. I want to read a familiar passage. Many of us, perhaps most of us, maybe all of us, except for our youngest, could quote it. Beginning verse 13. Let no one say when he's tempted, I'm tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempteth no man. But each man is tempted when he is drawn away by his own lust and enticed. When lust has conceived, it brings forth sin. And when sin is full grown, it brings forth death. There are certain experiences of man which are universal. One of the universal experiences of man is that each and every one of us struggles with temptation. That includes even the Son of God, who, though he never stepped outside the will of God, was tempted in all points, like as we are, yet without sin, the Hebrew writer tells us. And along with the trials that the Lord endured, or the temptations he endured trials as well. In fact, in Luke 22 and verse 28, he told his disciples, "You have been with me through my trials." Certainly, based upon our own experience, there is not a single solitary one of us that does not realize the truthfulness of the statement of the Apostle Peter in 1 Peter 5 and verse 8, when he described the devil as our adversary and further described him as a roaring lion, going about seeking whom he may devour. Each of us constantly meets Satan along the way, and we hear him as he says to us, Why do you want to walk so closely in the narrow way? Why do you want to submit yourself to another one? Don't you understand that the watchword of the day is to assert self? Why don't you assert yourself a little bit more? Why don't you reach out and get the power and get the enjoyment that comes from self-assertion? Or as the advertisement used to say, go for the gusto. After all, you only go around once. But our universal experience also teaches us that those who toy with temptation constantly get into trouble. If you don't believe that, look around you in the city of Houston. And just in case you don't live in Houston proper, I'm talking about greater Houston. Look, if you will, at any high school or college campus, and see that each of those scenes is characterized by sexual immorality, by perversion, by alcohol and drug abuse, by violence, by music with lyrics composed by the father of lies. And you and I, and our children live among it, are exposed to it, and are tempted by it. The truth of the matter is that as you sit here tonight, Satan has a plan for your life. Satan has a plan for your life, and it is ugly. He hopes to wreck your marriage. He hopes to rob you of the confidence that you need to be a good parent. He plans to plague you with doubts about God. He plans to worry you with financial concerns. He wants to debilitate your body. He wants to distort your values. He wants to fill you with despair and discouragement to the point that you believe there is no future, there is no hope. You and I, as we stand in the midst of this war and struggle with temptation, are concerned. Concern for ourselves, and that concern grows as we see people with whom we have been associated in the body of Jesus Christ who have acted responsibly, but who all of a sudden, as we sometimes describe it, just seem to go wild. But we know what happened. They toyed with temptation, and they fell. And most of us from time to time feel like the title of the book that I ran across and purchased, oh, probably a year or two ago, and in which I've even read some. But I'm notorious for buying books by titles. That's why I have 2 and 3 copies of some books, because they've got the same title. And I don't remember that I got them the last trip to the bookstore. But we find ourselves in our experience in the title of that book, which is, Lord, I can resist anything but temptation. The question is, what can you and I do about it? Are we forever condemned to be engaged in a struggle that we are destined to lose, or can we do something about it? Turn over to James chapter 4. Verse 7. Submit therefore to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. James tells us what we can do about it. But the problem that you and I have with James' statements is that sometimes when we read that, it just appears to be in the abstract. It doesn't seem to have any flesh on it. It doesn't seem to have any reality. It's theoretical. And we need some practice. We need some application. So let's turn to another passage. I'll give you a minute for this one, the book of Judges. Chapter 13. We're going to talk about a man, the name of whom our very young people up here at the front will recognize. The strong man of the Old Testament by the name of Samson. And one of the first things I want you to notice about Samson in Judges chapter 13 is that Samson was born in very favorable circumstances. Verses 1 and 2. Describe a certain man of Zorah of the family of the Danites whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and bore no children. But out of all of the people who were available to God, God sent a messenger. He picked these two people, Manoah and his wife. And that gives us an insight into the nature of these two people and what godly people they were. And in verse 3, we read that the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Behold, now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and give birth to a son." Now Manoah and his wife not only had received that message, but they wanted to know everything that they could know. They were going to be good parents, and they wanted to know everything they could know about how they were supposed to direct the life of this child that God was going to give to them. Drop down to verse 8. Then Manoah entreated the Lord and said, "O Lord, please let the man of God whom thou hast sent come to us again, that he may teach us what to do for the boy who is to be born." And God listened to the voice of Manoah, verse 9 begins. And he sent his messenger again to the woman, who went to her husband and said, "He's here." And Manoah went, and they talked with this messenger, with this angel of Jehovah. Manoah is a very typical daddy. "Are you the man," he says in verse 11, "who spoke to the woman?" And he said, "I am." And Manoah said, "Now when your words come to pass, what shall be the boy's mode of life and his vocation?" I know, Manoah is saying, that this son that we're going to have is going to deliver Israel, but you know, what's the boy going to do for a living? What's going to be his lifestyle? How's he going to get along in life? The angel says, "Let the woman pay attention to all that I said." And among the other things they learn is that this child, Samson, is going to be a Nazarite. And you and I know what that means. It means that this young man is going to have a controlled diet. It means that this young man is not going to be able to touch any dead thing. It means that this young man is never going to be able to cut his hair, because those were the vows of the Nazarite. And so Samson is prophesied. Samson is born. And he makes his appearance on the scene. And when he makes his appearance on the scene, one of the first things we discover is that this man, Samson, we don't know anything about his youth. It's not revealed to us. But when as a man he appears, we know immediately that this man, Samson, has a character flaw. We learn very quickly about this man, Samson, that he has a lustful passion and that he makes no attempt at all to restrain it, or to use the word of James, to resist. As a matter of fact, when in chapter 14 he appears on the scene, the first thing that is said about him is he saw a woman. And if you'll read just a little bit further, you'll discover that the first words of Samson ever recorded in Scripture were the words, "I saw a woman." Samson, in his experiences, as recorded for us here, made four very fundamental errors. that led to his fall and to his destruction. What were they? Number one, Samson focused on the wrong objective. We've already looked at his first words, chapter 14, verses 2 and 3. And if you drop down to verse 7, we find this additional statement made about Samson. So he went down and talked to the woman, and she looked good to Samson. Read very carefully. There isn't a word that Samson says here about the woman's character. He isn't focused on what kind of person she is. He isn't focused on the fact that as a Philistine, she has no spiritual character in which a Jew could be interested at all. He is just interested at this point in pleasing himself, and he saw a woman who was pleasing to the eye. She looked good to Samson. Can't you just hear Samson talking with his buddies about what he's interested in with this woman? Let me ask you to read for something else. Look through the passage and see if you can find it. Do you realize that the woman's name is not even mentioned? Doesn't mention her name, nothing about her character, the kind of person she is. I saw a woman. She looked good to me. Number one, Samson was focused on the wrong objective. Number two, Samson handled his leisure carelessly. Here is the man who was to begin to deliver Israel, as the angel had said. And instead of being interested in and attending to his duties to begin to deliver Israel, is very apparent that Samson is only interested in pleasing himself. As a matter of fact, when Samson made one of his trips down to visit the woman, you recall the story of how a lion came out, and Samson just took that lion like it was a toy and killed it. Went on about his business. And on a subsequent trip, Samson passed by the carcass of that lion and saw that a hive of bees had made their home there and had made some honey. And Samson went and got some of that honey, and he ate the honey, and he took and gave some of it to his mama and his daddy to eat, but he did not tell them where he got it. You wonder why? Because you see, what Samson had done had been a violation of his Nazarite vow. He was not supposed to touch any dead thing. And he touched the carcass of the lion to get the honey and to eat it. But Samson was hungry, you see. And so his appetite and his need superseded his obligation and his vow to God as a Nazarite. But as careless as it was just the beginning. When he made a trip down for the wedding, he spent his leisure time playing games with the Philistines. And he propounded a riddle to them based upon his experience with the lion. And if they were not successful in disclosing the answer to the riddle, they were to give him 30 changes of clothes. They thought about it and thought about it, and they couldn't do it. But did you ever wonder what a God-given deliverer is doing sitting around with a bunch of mediocre rabble playing games with them? What he's doing sitting around here making friends with the people from whom he is supposed to deliver the people of God? Look at verse 15 in chapter 14. When the Philistines realized that they were sort of stuck on the riddle, they came to the woman that Samson was marrying and said, "Listen, do something for us. Entice your husband." You get that word? Lustful eye is not hard to spot, is it? Samson had already disclosed his character to these people. Entice your husband. No, Samson wasn't rigid. He wasn't narrow like his mama and daddy were. He just took the pendulum and he shoved it all the way over to the other end. And the scripture tells us around verse 17 of chapter 14 that she turned on the pressure. She cried for 7 days. I guess I'll have to sympathize with Samson a little bit here. I don't know of a man who can resist a woman's tears for 7 days. But she turned it on. And she put the pressure on. And Samson told her. And he lost. Now, they probably didn't like the way that Samson paid his debt because he went out and killed 30 of them and took their clothes and took the 30 changes of raiment and gave it to those to whom he had propounded the riddle. Well, surely Samson has learned something now about the use of his leisure time. Surely now Samson's going to improve a little bit. But the truth of the matter is that Samson does not learn a thing. When we find Samson down toward the end of the 15th chapter and into the beginning of the 16th chapter, he has judged 20 years and so time has passed. And you know what we find him doing? Spending time with a harlot down in Gaza. Samson still has not learned. Samson still is not interested in delivering Israel. Samson finishes with a harlot in Gaza and he's still on the prowl for a woman. And this time, Samson finds Delilah. Mistake number three. He developed a close allegiance with the wrong crowd. All of the time that Samson had spent with the Philistines, the wrong crowd was the catalyst. It was the major force that caused him to fall prey to Delilah and to the advances of Delilah. Verse 4, after this, it came about that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. And the lords of the Philistines came to her and said to her, "Entice him." Haven't we heard that word before? Haven't we heard that word before in connection with Samson and one of his women? Seduce him and get him to tell us what the source of his strength is. What's the secret of his strength? We're worried about Samson. I mean, he's something to be reckoned with. He can kill 1,000 of us with the jawbone of an ass and never break out in a sweat. And if you will find the source of his strength, we will entrap him and we will destroy him. Now, Delilah goes to Samson. Verse 6, chapter 16. Please tell me where your great strength is and how you may be bound to afflict you. Now, good folks, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see through that plot, do you? I mean, tell us how we can get your strength, and then we're going to take care of you, Samson. That's what Delilah is telling him. We will afflict you. And you notice what Samson does as he dallies with the wrong crowd? Samson says, you know, this sounds like fun. I'll just play along with these people. I'll just play this game. I'll play their game with them, and I won't get burned. So Samson said to her, if they bind me with 7 fresh cords that have not been dried, then I shall become weak and be like any other man. So the Philistines brought her the 7 cords, and she tied him up with those 7 cords. And then she shouted in his ear, said, the Philistines are upon you, Samson! And stood back to watch Samson be afflicted and destroyed. But Samson just got up, broke those little old cords, and the Philistines said, oops, they were in serious trouble. And they got taken care of. Well, same song, second verse. Delilah said to him, behold, you have deceived me and told me lies. Now please tell me how you may be bound. And by this time, Samson is really dancing to the addicting tune of temptation. He is really playing their game. He's into it now. And he says, well, I'll tell you what. You just get those folks to come and tie me up with 7 new ropes. And then they can take care of me. No problem. So he got tied up. And here come the Philistines. Samson, the Philistines about to get you. And Samson stands up and he breaks those ropes like they were so many threads. Spider webs even. And the Philistines once again say, oops, they're in serious trouble. But now comes same song, third verse. Samson, you're lying to me still. Now, Samson, be honest with me. Samson's been pretty successful up to this point. He's deceived them twice. He's whipped them twice. And so Samson decides he's going to take a bold step forward. Verse 13, if you weave the 7 locks of my hair with the web and fasten it with a pin, then I shall become weak and be like any other man. Samson is beginning to presume on the sacred. Samson now has begun to play with the sacred secret of his life. He's gone past the fresh cords. He's gone past the new ropes. And now he's talking about the secret of his strength. He's talking about his hair. Every step that Samson takes, he gets a little closer to the edge. All because Samson is making an alliance with the wrong crowd. He's playing with the wrong people. Ultimately, you know the story. The bottom line is, and this is Samson's fourth big mistake, Samson did not take his vow to God seriously. As a matter of fact, if you just want to take the word vow out of that sentence and put in the word God, it would be more appropriate. Samson did not take his God seriously. You remember the passage that we read in the beginning from James? Each man sins when he is drawn away by his own lust and enticed. That word enticed is a fisherman's word. It's the bait, it's the lure that you throw out there to get the attention of the fish. And there comes a moment in time when the only thing in this world that is real to that fish is that bait and that lure, and he doesn't know the hook is there. And that's what happened to Samson. There came a point in time when the only thing that was real to him was the game that he was playing with the wrong people, was his dalliance with the woman Delilah, his desire for her flesh. And when that took on all of the reality for Samson, God lost all of his. And that's when you and I fall to temptation, is when we are drawn away and we are enticed by our own lust because we do not take God seriously. We do not take him for real. Oh, how Samson was going to be free, how Samson was going to be everything that man wanted to be because of his dalliance. But what happened to Samson was he lost his strength, he lost his sight, he lost his freedom. Look, if you will, at verse 21, chapter 16. Then the Philistines seized him and gouged out his eyes, and they brought him down to Gaza and bound him with bronze chains, and he was a grinder in the prison. Sin binds. Sin blinds. Sin grinds. We're weakened. We're not strengthened. We think if we can just get up close to it, we're going to be able to handle it. But we get up close to it and it destroys us. I don't know how many of you, if any of you, have heard the story that Paul Harvey tells about how the Eskimos capture a wolf. They do it by taking a knife that they have sharpened to a very keen edge. And they get fresh blood and they put it on that blade and they freeze it. And then they put another layer on that knife and they freeze it until they get a fairly thick layer of blood on that knife. And then they stick it in the snow, hilt down, blade up. The wolf gets the scent of the blood. And he comes. And he licks it. And it is good. He licks it again. And it's better. And he licks it. And he licks it. Until finally the keen edge of the blade is exposed. And it is so sharp that he does not feel the laceration on his tongue. He continues to lick. Laceration. After laceration,
and the blood is getting better. And he stands there and he licks and he swallows the blood until he dies from losing and drinking his own blood. Listen, good people. Listen, young people. To what temptation did to Samson. But back to our original question. What can I do about it? Am I destined to be forever in the struggle? Am I destined to forever have the civil war raging and destined to lose it? Samson tells us what we can do about it. Number one, our natural focus must be counteracted. Don't focus on the wrong thing. Get a steady, daily habit of the study of the Word of God and communicating with God in prayer. Guard ever so carefully that gateway to the soul which is called the eye. You remember the words of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount? That the lamp of the body is the eye. If thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. But if the light that is in thee be darkness, how great is that darkness? You remember when we studied the book of Job, chapter 31 and verse 1, when Job said, I have made a covenant with my eyes, therefore how can I look upon a virgin? Guard your eyes and guard your soul. Our natural focus must be counteracted. Number two, our leisure time must be guarded. Plan your leisure time. Don't just let it happen. When do most of us get into trouble? When we're just sitting around, what do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? Well, I don't know. What do you want to do? And directly somebody comes in and they fill the void. We've been there. We've heard it. We've done it. Plan your leisure. Whether you're a student, or a man who travels away from home, or a woman who works at the office, or somewhere else, you've got leisure time, plan it and use it wisely. And don't just let it happen because the wrong thing is going to happen. Number three, our close companions need to be screened. Let me give you something you can take to the bank, you can depend on. And that's simply that until you clean up your companions, you'll never clean up your life. Evil companions still corrupt good morals. It's still easy to run with a multitude to do evil. Sit down and closely look at your companions, the people with whom you spend time, and decide in light of who you are and what you are and whose child you are, who you can afford to spend time with, and underline that word afford. You cannot afford. It costs too much to spend time with some folks. Oh, I will convert them, you may say. But you're not going to convert them where you're spending time with them. Doesn't work that way. Number four. God must be upheld. Just as surely as we honor our marriage vows, let us honor our vows to our God. Our primary vow
I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service, and be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. That was your vow. When you came before an assembly like this one and said, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. When you were buried in the waters of baptism and you arose to walk in newness of life, that was your vow. Be true to it. And don't let temptation take you away. Satan cannot, must not be ignored. He's got to be resisted. You've got to stand up to him. You have a choice. And the decision is not the decision of your mama and your daddy. It's not the decision of your husband and your wife. Ultimately, the decision belongs to you, and you've got to decide for yourself. Am I going to be true to my God? Am I going to be true to my vow? Am I going to resist the devil so that he will flee from me? It starts with submitting to God. Go back and read James chapter 4. Submit to God. Resist the devil, and he'll flee from you. Draw near to God, and he'll draw near to you. How many of us have that backwards? Oh, I'll draw near to God when he draws near to me. It's not what he said. As his child, you draw near to God. And God will draw near to you. If you want to keep him away from him, you just stay where you are. And don't draw near to him. You haven't submitted to him by being born again into his family, by water and the Spirit, baptized for the remission of your sins. You need to do that tonight and become his child. And then as his child, you need to resist the devil. Draw near to God. He'll draw near to you. He'll help you. And he'll lead you home and triumphantly into the heavenly city. That's his promise, and he is faithful. If you're subject to his invitation, won't you come while we stand and while we sing?